Mary Beth, whenever you're ready.
Lunch was delivered to the table at 5 minutes of one. Give me just a minute. I'll be ready here. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are moving along to the actual item on the priorities themselves. We have talked about them a little bit. And the committee motion, I'll wait for Joan to put it up. Primarily, the committee approved the AP recommendation. So on behalf of the committee, we recommend that the council approve the AP recommendations for 2015 and 16 RSA priorities. And I make this motion on behalf of the committee, and I also will be offering an amendment, which is really doesn't change the motion substantially, but it adds some clarification. So I can do that now or wait. What's your preference?
No, let's get some comment from the audience. If there's anyone who'd like to comment, and then when we bring it back to the table, you can make your amendment.
Okay, and I would just want to add one comment based on Deirdre's presentation before we do that, and that is that I think we've come to a realization that we have a really long list of research priorities here, and then we may want to look at this in a different way in the future so that the request for proposals is a little more succinct, and there was a short discussion about that. We were not able to do that this year, but next year after we'll have a benchmark assessment, we'll have this meeting in March that was referenced earlier looking at the different survey methodology, and we'll be in a better position to do that. So I just make that one caveat.
Okay, thanks. Are there any comments from the audience on the motion on the board? Our two commenters are still out for lunch. Back to the council and back to John's question to Deirdre prior to our break concerning ocean acidification.
Sure, thank you. That issue did come up, and there was discussion, John, about where to place that item. And there was a project funded in 2014 RSA to look into that work, and I believe it is actually a two-year project. So something has been funded recently. But really, I think the main driver from the AP level and the committee level was that that's a really big issue. It's a very large topic. Realistically, it probably requires a lot of funding and something that may, while you'd want to kind of chip away at it, it might be a little more than the RSA can handle. And it was more a discussion of these really bigger picture things. I think the AP, my impression anyway, and you can see more in the meeting summaries, was that they kind of were hoping that larger groups and other sources could start funding that kind of research. Other federal agencies and just bigger, it was a little beyond maybe the scope of the original intent of the RSA projects. Not that people don't think it's important and they agree about the magnitude of potential impacts, but it's just it's a really big question that really would require huge efforts.
Mary Beth.
So just to add to that a little bit, when we recommended that priority, I think people envisioned that we could put monitors on dredges and collect a lot of data, and that would be extremely useful. And since that time, what little I know about it, it sounds like that technology is not readily available. And so I think some of the discussion around the RSA is, do we want to use RSA funds to develop technology? And maybe that was best done by another process.
Tom. Nice.
Deirdre, I just wanted to ask a question on a specific RSA priority, just a language question, and it's on one of the survey ones. It's on paragraph C under the broad resource area surveys. The language starts out broad resource-wide industry-based survey, singular, of scallops within Georgia's Bank or Mid-Lac resource areas. Then it goes on to talk about the primary objectives of these surveys, plural. This year there seemed to be some sort of confusion about whether this priority meant to having one survey that covered the whole area or whether it could be multiple surveys, each that cover part of the area. And it's not clear to me how this particular language here is meant to refer.
Mary Beth, can I answer that one?
Yeah, and then, Deirdre, feel free to follow up. But I would want to note that the committee did have a discussion about this, and there was a question that was asked by a committee member on this particular topic. And we, just by nodding our heads, agreed that, you know, what this means is that, you know, the survey might not mean one survey across a broad scale. It might mean multiple surveys, you know, done by different entities, perhaps, whatever, to achieve the goal of having broad coverage. So if people think that the way it's written isn't clear enough, we could make some adjustments or just include the intent of the committee here so that when they do the request for proposals, the agency feels that they have the correct interpretation when they ask for them.
Are there any other comments on the joint AP committee recommendations? Dave.
Yeah, just a very quick one with regard to John's question before. The fundamental difference that was applied here, and we did have these discussions, is the difference between pure research and applied research. And typically, pure research is much more expensive, and it typically deals with science at the conceptual level, and you develop new ideas from which technology comes through applied research. And in our discussions that I've been involved with, it's pretty clear that this kind of a research funding mechanism is a good example of applied research for a specific function in a specific industry. And that's true not just in fisheries, but across the board.
Are there any other comments? Mary Beth, did you want to amend this motion or make a separate motion if we vote this up or down?
I think it would be cleaner to just amend this so that it's all together.
Okay.
So I think Joan has some language, but I will read it. The motion as it reads is fine, and I would just add at the end, but clarify that scallop survey-related priorities be removed for the second year, fishing year 2016 period. Instead, scallop survey-related priorities should be reviewed after the independent survey methods meeting and potentially modified before the next RSA announcement for fishing years 2016 and 2017. So, you know, sort of background on this, some conversations have gone on since the meeting, and we are going to have that methods.
Let's get a second.
Oh, certainly.
Second, but without Laura here, PK, you're taking over.
So with a second, do you want me to continue? Okay. So we're going to have this methods review, and our priorities may change. And we have a cycle here in which we request proposals, or the agency does, for up to 2 years. And we, in this instance, don't want people putting a lot of effort into two-year proposals if we're going to change our priorities midway through. So this is clean. It lets people know that for, you know, survey proposals, just the 1 year, and then it'll come back to all of us to see if our priorities remain the same.
Are there any other comments on the motion to amend? Seeing none, those who support the motion to amend, please indicate so. Motion carries 14-0. Same sign on the main motion as amended. The motion carries 14-0. Mary Beth.
So one final issue under the research set aside, and this was a recommendation from the committee. I don't have a motion. It is a consensus statement. And the request is to send a letter to the agency seeing if they could change or move up the date for the survey methods review that is currently scheduled for March of 2015. And the thinking behind that was, you know, if we could move that up, that these research set-aside priorities could be addressed more quickly. And, Deirdre, if you want to add anything to that, please do.
Nope. I think that's it. I think the issue here, the committee was responding to the advisors. This originally came from them, just this interest in trying to get this ahead and earlier. But so far, my impression is that the center placed this date as early as they could already.
Tom.
I guess before Jim weighs in here, I'm curious by what the committee means by how much earlier. I mean, or how much earlier would the survey review have to be in order to fit into the cycle? So if the council does submit a letter, want to send a letter, we can be a little more clear about how early we mean. Remembering that if there is a survey meeting, it'll probably, and it is independently peer-reviewed, which I think is the plan, it'll probably be a month to 6 weeks before the final results are actually available. So what do you mean by earlier? Do you mean a couple weeks earlier? Do you mean it has to be, the meeting has to be in January so you have the information by the end of February so you can do the research set aside? Do you mean it needs to be in the fall?
Yep, thanks for the question. The committee wasn't specific about it in their consensus statement. Since the meeting, I have spoken with staff at the Science Center in the cooperative research team about this, and realistically, in order for it to be effective and available before decisions have to be made for next year's round of RSA awards, it really honestly would have to happen in the fall, so that a lot of these preliminary decisions are made almost in December, and then a full package is sent to headquarters and so forth to go through the NOAA grants review. So really, no, it wouldn't be a matter of weeks. It would be a matter of months that it would need to be earlier to matter.
So, I mean, I'm perfectly happy to write a letter if that's what the chair wants, but and the council want. But I just want to point out that the fall is just a non-starter. I mean, I don't think we even have to turn to Jim. We already had the NRCC meeting where we agreed on scheduling. We have a fairly full fall plan already, a number of items. I don't even think that they could potentially be ready to do it, even if they had the openings to have it by the fall. So I just think the council, should they decide to send the letter, just needs to expect that the reply is probably going to be no.
Mark.
Thank you. In fairness to the researchers, wouldn't the results of this meeting be of interest to them? I mean, as far as, I mean, that would certainly dictate the types and the details of the proposals that you get. So if it can't be moved up, then maybe the present schedule would be good for the following funding cycle. So.
Mike?
I'm not clear if we're contemplating a motion that the council chair send such a letter, or we're discussing whether the council wants to agree to this by consensus. Either one, I'm not in favor of it. Well, as Tom has already pointed out, I just don't think it's going to change in terms of the timing. And if there was some flexibility to change the timing of anything, I would put a much higher priority on advancing groundfish assessments for the reasons that we discussed yesterday than I would on this. And they are related. I mean, you can be sure Paul Rago is going to be up to his neck in both as just one person that counts a lot in this. So they are related. And beyond that, I honestly don't think that this review is really addressing the core problem that's we're facing with respect to all of this angst about surveys. So I wouldn't be in favor of sending such a letter.
Well, without a consensus here, we would need someone who would be willing to make a motion. If not, we are going to move on to the IFQ report. Mary Beth.
So I guess I would prefer to maybe hear from a couple of other committee members. I mean, I'd be happy to make a motion, but if people's thinking today is that it's not going to happen, so maybe we don't need the letter, I'm fine with that. I don't need to make a motion, but I would feel more comfortable, since I'm supposed to represent the committee's intent here, if we heard from a few of those people.
Jim.
Well, thank you. This is a meeting that will take time to prepare for. Not only carrying out the meeting is a big deal, but this is the kind of meeting where there are going to be CIE reviewers brought in, as well as some additional experts to fill out the panel. And they have to cover a wide range of expertise, all the way from statistical survey methods to optical technologies. And so the purpose of the review will be to not only evaluate what's used in each of the different kinds of surveys that are done and their methods, but then to come out the other end with some recommendations about ways to go forward. So I think that what will come out at the other end will be very helpful for guiding the RSA, but I don't think it's something that can be rushed, given the time it takes to get the right reviewers. And the people who are going to participate in the review also have to prepare a lot of stuff to present to the reviewers. Then the we'll also be supporting Framework 26 on scallops, and we're currently doing the SARC on scallops. So there are a lot of scallops going on already, and it'll continue through the fall. So those are some of the reasons, in addition to the NRCC discussion, to plan what we would be doing this year. All of that, the center would like to keep it in March, and we'd been intending to do this review a year ago, and if you recall, there had to be a choice made between the Georges Bank Yellowtail work and the scallop methods review. At that time, the council chose Georges Bank Yellowtail, and that was done. And so this is still on the schedule, and we're trying to do it as soon as we can, given all the other things that we have to do. Thanks.
David.
Yeah, Jim has given a good summary of the history behind this request by the council to have this independent review of the different survey methods, so I won't go there, and he's quite correct. We did have to make a choice in light of the resources available to the service to do all this important work. And Dr. Karp, he's well aware of the concern of this council. I've had many conversations with him about this issue, as has different council members around the table. So it's a concern about this is well known. Therefore, even though I would like to draft a letter and send it, it will do no good. And frankly, I'm satisfied that the center, through Dr. Karp and company, are doing everything they can to get this done as soon as possible. And there's the date. So we live with it, and we wait to see how it all ends up.
Does anybody else wish to comment or feel differently? We don't have a motion up, Drew. Very, very quickly.
All right. Drew Minkiewicz, Fisher Survival Fund. Send the letter, don't send the letter. For whatever reason, the government has made this more complicated than it needs to be. We're just going to go ahead and host this meeting and have it done. If the government wants to come along, great. But we're just going to do it because, as usual, we have to take care of ourselves. So we will.
Okay. I think we're ready for the IFQ report.
So Dieter has a presentation on the IFQ review, so you should have a copy of her slides.
Thank you. This is a presentation. I'm going to give the first half, and Demet Haxeveron, our staff, is going to give the second half. It is document number 9, are the presentation slides. I did notice the audience copies aren't numbered, but it does have 2 slides per page, and the title is there, so hopefully you can find the right presentation. The document itself, the IFQ report, is document number 7, in case you want to reference it during this presentation. So we're going to hopefully just do kind of a pretty brief summary of this report today. We've gone through it in great detail at several PDT meetings, and then more recently with the advisors and committee last month. So we're just going to try to highlight some of the bigger picture things that this report covered, but it's, as you can see from the thickness of it, there's quite a lot of information in it. Very quickly, just a background, refresh your memory, because the PDT has been working on this for quite a while. The council originally initiated this report for 4 primary reasons. At the time, about 2 years ago now, I think the groundfish sector management program got a pretty big review, And I think at the time, the atmosphere was, hey, that was a pretty good idea. We learned a lot, identified some trends for improvement. So let's give a look at the IFQ program as well. It's also around a similar time we got the results from the Touchtone report, which suggested that every once in a while the council should do sort of an FMP performance review. So everyone's kind of in the mood for that kind of thing. Also, the Magnuson-Stevens Act does require that after 5 years, any LAP program should get, you know, an official 5-year review. This is not that. This is just looking at the first 3 years, but the idea being that we could kind of see what it was about, see what types of issues should be included in that more formal 5-year review. And that was one idea about what this report could do. And finally, also at the time, the council was considering whether to potentially implement LAPs for other fisheries in the region, and if there were lessons that could be learned from this program, the idea was we could look at it specifically with the monkfish plan at the time was considering whether that was a fruitful way to go. So we did use a lot of these different reports and ideas about how to structure this report and the kinds of things we would cover when the PDT was developing this for the committee. The general outline of the report, there's some background information, a little historical description of the general category fisheries since it was adopted in Amendment 4 in 1994. Some of the variables, we did try to put them in four general categories: biological, economic trends, safety and enforcement, as well as governance. And then we just have some sort of references and acknowledgments at the end. We tried when we could in each of those variables and overall topics to draft a kind of take-home conclusion for each of these variables. And when we felt that it was kind of important enough or something we really wanted to highlight, we tried to draft a PDT finding. So throughout the report, there's really only three overall PDT findings that I would say the committee spent more time discussing in terms of whether those should turn into future potential actions and so forth. So I'll just highlight those as I go through some of these. Very briefly, the FMP began in 1982, again, limited entry. Came under Amendment 4. The general category fishery was left open access at that point for vessels that did not qualify for a limited entry permit. Kind of went along for a while until 1999. You started to see an increase in general category effort over time. And really after 2003, it jumped up about 1 million pounds a year until the height in 2006 when it was about 7 million pounds annually. The control date was established for this fishery, November 1st, 2004, and after that time, the council began developing Amendment 11, which ultimately did become a limited entry program with this IFQ program included. An overall allocation was given to the fishery of 5.5% of the resource, and three different general category permits were developed: the IFQ permit, the Northern Gulf of Maine, and incidental. They are all three limited entry permits. So the number of these permits, obviously going from open access to limited entry, did decline pretty dramatically right away from 2,500 to about 750, and that includes all three of those limited entry general category permit types. In terms of active vessels, there are about, you know, for years there are about 200 active general category vessels, but during that height, that again steadily increased to about 600. And now is kind of back down to about that 200 level. Most IFQ vessels are dredge gear and homeported in Massachusetts and New Jersey. They are sprinkled up and down the coast, of course, but those are the primary states. And some vessels are very dependent on scallops for their overall revenue, and the majority of vessels are not. It's a pretty diverse fleet in general. It was and still is. So jumping right into the variables that we looked at in terms of the biological performance of this fishery, in the report that begins on page 30 of the document, the beginning of the document is really a lot more background information. Page 30, we get into the actual biological performance. This is very basic. Really, the plan development team just looked at what the sub-ACL was each year for this fishery and then compared that to what the final catch ended up being for the fishery. Tables 11 and 12 in the document really summarize that by year, and you can see that, you know, on average for the first 3 years of the program, it is quite successful in terms of catching about 95% of the sub-ACL in terms of harvest. So it hasn't been over, and it hasn't been largely under either. The PDT did have its first finding related to this topic, and it has to do with carryover. After Amendment 11 was implemented, pretty soon after, a carryover provision was included later to allow general category vessels to carry up to 15% of their individual quota from one fishing year to the next. So the PDT spent a little time looking into this and comparing that amount of carryover and seeing if there were any initial trends that we could learn about. And so far, at this point, it does not seem to be a large issue. There is some carryover, and the amount of carryover has increased since the program first began and allowed it. However, it's not at some very large level, and right now the PDT feels it's de minimis in terms of its potential impact to affect the resource. However, we're recommending in the report that it be monitored, and if it does become an issue, a sub-ACT could potentially be considered. In terms of bycatch, moving on, bycatch, we really only focused on the yellowtail stocks, since this is just the first 3 years of the program. Again, the general finding here is that overall, this fishery is not expected to have a very large impact on bycatch overall for the scallop fishery, so we didn't really have a lot to highlight here. Economic performance is obviously the vast majority of this report. It starts on page 34 of the document. DeMet has several slides after I'm finished, so I'm going to skip over this topic and let her cover that section since she's the primary person that worked on that section for the document. So skipping over to safety and enforcement, we did do what we could to kind of gather as much information related to safety and enforcement of this fleet, kind of keeping in line with this being a possible variable when you have an IFQ program. You read about, you know, increased stewardship and ability to reinvest in your vessels to safer platforms and so forth. So we tried to get our hands on as much information as we could for this subject. The first one, we got some data from the Coast Guard participant on our plan development team who provided basically a catalog of the different vessel casualties, which is basically any time the Coast Guard is called to a vessel at sea for a variety of reasons. You can see in Table 19. In the document, there's a catalog of all the different types of vessel casualties that happen by fishing year, and we tried to pull out the ones for the general category fishery to see if there was any kind of difference. Really, overall, after getting all of that information, we didn't feel because vessel casualties could occur still on the safest platform in the fishery, we didn't feel that there was really anything to note that really would, there's too many variables involved to come up with any real conclusions about vessel safety changing for this IFQ fishery since it started. So we didn't really want to make any conclusions here. Moving on to vessel age as a possible indicator for vessel safety, we did look at vessel age over time. Again, it's been a pretty short time, a matter of 3 years, and overall it's actually been very stable. We did notice, however, that vessels that are tending to lease quota in from other vessels is, again, pretty stable in terms of leasing in and leasing out. However, vessels that are permanently transferring, that means, you know, selling, not just leasing, permanently transferring quota in, are seeming to go, on average, onto vessels that are newer compared to the ones they're coming from. Again, these are not anything that were really surprising results to the PDT or the advisors when we share this information with them. So then we get into kind of more compliance and enforcement issues, and this is probably where we spent a lot more time at the advisors and committee level. The information is a bit limited in terms of what we're able to pull together to describe, but we tried to look at the number of violations in this fishery, and again, from all the different sources and so forth, it really is pretty limited. We did note a very small decline in terms of the number of violations over time in each year. Again, many of these violations were not due to things having to do with the IFQ program directly. They were much more, the vast majority of them had to do with the observer program requirements. So really by the time we kind of got all this data, we didn't feel that we could say a lot about it in terms of conclusions. It's pretty limited information. One thing we looked at moving on was VMS pre-landing requirements. Because this is an IFQ program, vessels are required to basically tell NIMS when they're coming to port. Within 6 hours is the requirement of where they're going to land, how much they have on board, and an approximate time of when they expect to land. So that arguably they could be met at the dock and that offload could be monitored to improve that. In general, when we looked at this overall, at first we were pretty concerned that about 15 to 20% of all the trips for the fishery were not in compliance. Basically, they did not send a pre-landing report to NIMS. So that was kind of alarming to us when we first started looking at it. When we looked a little deeper, we learned that really this is all coming from a pretty small fraction of the fleet never doing it. So it's not as though the entire fleet is just not calling in some of the trips. There are some chronic vessels that are never doing it. So they either maybe don't, they're not aware of the requirement, or so there might be an issue there. The agency, as I understand it, is already and probably has been all along communicating with some of these vessels, but there is a subset of vessels that are definitely not complying with this, which is reducing the overall ability to effectively monitor the program was basically the conclusion from the plan development team. So we do have our second finding related to this topic. We felt that this was important enough to highlight, recommending that NIMS ensure that these vessels that are not complying with this do start complying with it. And we did talk to the advisors about this. We didn't really get a lot of insight from that discussion. A lot of everybody there knew about it. They were kind of surprised with these results as well. We also looked at the monitored offloads, as I was mentioning, and kind of what we learned is there really has been very little on-site monitoring of this IFQ program since it began in 2010. Especially in the first year, there was really very little at all, is what kind of I understand. The next two fishing years, the level of presence increased, and over the next two fishing years, approximately 140 offloads were monitored for the fishery overall. Again, digging a little deeper, we learned that really most of those were pretty centralized in one or two ports, so it's not a very widespread effort to date. The good news is that none of those offloads resulted in any violations of a possession limit or exceeding an IFQ, which is good. However, you know, the PDT kind of concluded that the presence has been pretty low, so we weren't really making any strong conclusions about it. Finally, moving on to IFQ overages was another place we thought if we looked on a vessel basis, we could get a sense of if vessels were exceeding their individual fishing quotas. And at this time, this does not seem to be a major issue. There is a subset of vessels each year that are in excess of their individual quotas. In many cases, it's not a lot, you know, less than 500 pounds, but definitely in some cases, it is much greater than that. It does seem to be different vessels each year. When you really dig into the data, it's not, you know, the same vessel every single year, you know, in terms of a chronic issue. But again, we're highlighting this as something I think people were a little surprised of and not understanding at the committee level anyway, how someone could continue to be fishing without, you know, quotas to pounds to cover it. So there is a table in the document that tries to give you a better sense of what these overages are. However, the good news here, within the next year, vessels were able to have quota that following year to cover any overages from the year before. But technically, you are in violation if you fish for scallop quota without enough quota to cover it. Okay, so moving from that topic, we get into governance. Again, the PDT tried to just think big picture stuff here to get a sense of the general governance of this program. We went back to the primary goals and objectives of Amendment 11, tried to look at them kind of one at a time and go through a pretty basic systematic, you know, have we met this goal, have we met that goal. We went through them one at a time. You can see it in the document where we try to link things back. And these are looking at pretty big picture things. Have we been able to control capacity? Is there a limited entry program? Are we preventing excess catch? And so forth. So probably won't go through these, but they are all described starting on page 113. We even spent a little time. I will highlight this. I'm sorry. The committee did spend quite a bit of time actually discussing the overall governance. We had a long discussion at the committee level about these concerns about monitoring and the sense that there is this individual vessel quota that all of these vessels have. And are we being naive with these, you know, relatively low levels of enforcement presence you know, do we feel pretty confident that we're actually staying within these individual quotas as a fishery? Overall, it looks like it's a good job in terms of the overall ACL, but how confident are we that we're actually staying under these catch levels? So the committee, as you'll see in the meeting summary, highlighted this issue, and they kind of didn't complete their discussion in terms of what's the best next step. We could look at the report a little more closely in terms of refining some of the language. We could send some of these concerns to the Enforcement Committee, possibly look at a future action. I think we'll probably talk about this a lot more after the presentation is complete. But I just forgot that I had a slide in here, one specific area that was highlighted at the committee level. Sorry, so moving on, the vision statement. If you remember, there was a pretty detailed vision statement that was developed in Amendment 11. And again, we tried to kind of really hone in on that and see how the plan is doing so far in terms of maintaining relatively small vessels, maintaining a possession limit, and having vessels have access to this resource at various levels. And so far, it seems that, you know, for the most part, the plan is still meeting these three, you know, major parts of the vision statement. In terms of GenCat representation at the council process, again, this is a very basic approach. The plan development team tried to just get a sense of general category direct membership on the advisory panels, and very vague. We're just kind of describing it as adequate. There are, you know, at least a third of the general category of the seats on the Scallop AP are general category participants. Similar at the council level itself, we felt that the direct representation of general category interests in general at the council table was also adequate, is how we described it, and, you know, just that it was a pretty adequate representation of their interests. Frequency and locations of meetings, we were hoping, you know, to kind of get a lot of input from the advisors if they were feeling this was adequate from their perspective. And, you know, not a lot of comments, just that the meetings did seem frequent enough and in locations that were convenient enough for most of the fleet. Okay, almost done here. How quickly have changes occurred in this plan? This was interesting. We tried to catalog all of the different modifications that have been made to the IFQ program since it was adopted. And considering it's been 3 years and many of these were actually adopted within the first year, for council level stuff, this is pretty impressive. It's a pretty long list of things that have been modified in this program already to date. So this was a pretty positive sign anyway that, you know, when things were not as the program wanted them to be, the council was able to adjust those and modify them. Finally, cost recovery is arguably another way to get a sense of the governance of this overall IFQ program. Every IFQ program is mandated by the Magnuson Act to have a cost recovery fee. A maximum of up to 3% of the ex-vessel value can be collected by the agency. So we took a look at this from the first 3 years. And to date, roughly about $100,000 is what the estimate is from the agency of the direct cost that they bear to administer the program. And this comes out to be less than half a percentage of the ex-vessel value. So every year, bills have been sent out to IFQ owners. And each year, people have paid them. All bills have been paid on time. The range of fees, depending on the quota that you own, range from $10 to over $3,000 per vessel. So this is just sort of more informative. But in terms of governance, everyone's paying their bills, paying them on time. And that's about it. I think that covers all of the variables we tried to kind of hone in on in this report. And then Demet has some slides about the economic performance and some of the things that we're seeing from the first 3 years of the program. If I can turn it right to her.
No, and can I get... Going to the first slide, this is I have to synchronize this with my slides here for a second. Okay. So this is an evaluation of the LAGC IFQ fishery, economic performance of this fishery for the 3 fishing years since the implementation of Amendment 11 in 2010. And these analyses do not include the limited access vessels that also have an IFQ permit. Now, the document, the report has several subsections analyzing the landings, LPUE, revenues, profits, leasing and transfer activity, effort by vessels, owners, employment, crew shares, economic dependency, fleet diversity, and some other metrics. So these were all in the subsections of 3.3 of your document. In analyzing these trends, it is important to distinguish the impacts of factors that were external to the functioning of the IFQ program itself than the factors that were directly the results of this program. Due to the favorable scallop resource conditions, in these 3 years, ACL for the IFQ fishery increased by 33% in 2012 from 2010 levels. At the same time, there was an increase in scallop egg vessel prices from $8 to $8.70 to over $10 per pound since 2011. And there was also an increase in the possession limit from 400 pounds to 600 pounds. Although the possession limit is a part of this fishery, we wanted to look at its impacts separately from the impacts of the IFQ program itself that enabled the vessels lease or transfer their IFQs to other owners. Now, the second slide shows the fleet-wide trends in gross revenues and net revenues. They were all positive due to the increase in the ACL for this fishery and the scallop prices. So as a result, the scallop revenue increased from 20 million pounds in 2010 to about 30 million pounds in 2012, which is a 48% increase. And by the way, all the revenues and all the variables in dollars, they were all expressed in inflation-adjusted 2012 values in these slides. In addition to the gross revenues, we also estimated the net revenues for the fleet and per owner and per vessel. Net revenue estimates are net of leasing and trip costs, and there is a lot of description in this section related to leasing about how we estimated these costs. There was a lot of data available, but then we had to do some other assumptions. And we estimated the trip cost from the observer data, and that is described in Appendix 1 in more detail, so I'm not going to go through those. And the net earnings for the inactive vessels here included their earnings from leasing out only. And I want to emphasize here that net revenue estimates are not equivalent to profits because they do not include fixed costs, and also they do not include the borrowing costs of the vessels that lease quota from others. The results show that the net revenue for the fleet as a whole increased from 16.9 million in 2010 to slightly over 26 million in 2012, which was a 54% increase. Now, as opposed to those fleet-wide trends in gross and net revenues, which were mostly driven by the increase in the IFQ, ACL, and the prices. The trends in the effort and the consolidation of effort in fewer vessels and owners were direct results of the IFQ program due to its flexibility to let the owners to lease or transfer their quota. As a result of this, those owners with smaller allocations find it more profitable to transfer or lease out their quota instead of incurring trip costs or the fixed costs such as maintenance or insurance and other costs. And those owners with more sizable allocations found it profitable to increase the size of their operations by leasing or by buying quota from others. So as a result of these changes, the number of permits declined from 311 in 2010 to 302 in 2012. These include the permits in CPH as well, and there were about 64 permits in confirmation permit history, just permits with no vessels associated with them. Number of active vessels declined from 154 to 129, and the inactive permits increased to 173. Number of active owners declined from 127 to 107. And the number of inactive owners who lease out their shares increased from 62 to 72. Next slide provides some information about the permanent transfers. There is a lot of detailed information about this in the document. But in summary, permanent IFQ transfers surged in fishing year 2012. Before that, only 1% of the total IFQ allocations were transferred. But as the scallop prices increased and the ACL increased since 2011, the transfers increased to 5%, over 5% of the total allocations. In 2013, they were back down to 1.6% of the total allocations. During the same time, average price of the transfer quota increased from $13 per pound to about $23 per pound, which is a 70% increase. And this had some impact on the owners or vessels that lease IFQ from others. As opposed to permanent transfers, which were relatively minor, there was a very extensive leasing activity since 2010. By 2012, about 32% of the total annual IFQ leased out to vessels with different owners. If we included the leasing between vessels, including the same owner, transfers, these temporary transfers, that's what usually leasing activity is referred to, then the total leasing would be about 45% of the total allocations in 2012. Again, as the scallop prices and the ACL increased, there has been an increase in the average leasing prices from about $1.79 in 2010 to over $2.44 in 2012. So as a result of this increase in the total fleet revenues and the consolidation of effort in fewer vessels and owners, average gross revenue per active owner increased by 76% during this period. And the average net revenue, again, just to remind us, net of trip and leasing costs for active owners increased by 77%. And average revenue for the inactive owners increased more than 100% because of the increase in lease prices. This slide shows the distribution of average, not distribution, but the, shows the average net revenue by lease groups. It shows that the leasing group had the largest net revenue. Their revenues in 2012 were close to $290,000. And then the owners, average net revenue for the owners in the lease out group was about $60,000. And in the no-lease group, the average was about $130,000. Now, in terms of increase, however, the rate of growth in the net revenue was lowest for the lease-in group, 44% from 2010 levels due to the increase in lease prices, lease costs for this group. And lease out group, for the lease out group, net revenues, average net revenue increased by 55%. And for the net lease group, average net revenue more than doubled because this group doesn't incur any lease costs. And also, there was a lot of consolidation of effort in this group. And here I like to point out that the net revenues of the leasing group may be overestimated because we didn't have information about the borrowing costs for owners who lease out quota from others by getting bank loans. We don't have information about their interest payments and others. So that could be a little bit overestimated. And there is also a note in this slide. I want to point out that the group, lease out group, includes some owners who are net leasers of quota, but also they use part of their allocations to fish for scallops. So if we just looked at the average net revenues for the inactive owners, which don't have any scallop landings, their average net revenue in 2012 was about $26,000. Next slide summarizes the trends in total days ACLPUE and some geographical shifts. Again, there's a lot of detailed information in the document about these. The total days at sea fish by the LAGC IFQ vessels declined by 6% in 2012, mostly due to the increase in the possession limits and also the decline in the number of vessels, and the distribution of effort have had an effect in this decline. Because of the decline in the number of trips and trip duration, the landings per trip increased from 343 pounds in 2010 to over 520 pounds in 2012. Similarly, if we table 16 in your document expresses this in terms of LPUE, converts this to actual days fished. And there has been a similar increase in the LPUE. Now, in terms of there were some geographical shifts, the main one was that the share of active vessels from Massachusetts in total allocations and landings increased, and Massachusetts became the main state with net leasing of quota from other states. And the main reasons for this were the favorable scallop resource conditions in the New England areas compared to mid-Atlantic areas, and also the existence of the permanent banks might have an impact on this shift. Next slide provides a very short summary of the profits, employment, and career incomes. In order to estimate profits, we needed fixed cost estimates, and that was provided to us in late April. Cost surveys of 2011 and 2012 included information, extensive information. However, as we will mention later, the sample of the IFQ vessels included in surveys were quite small, but we used whatever information we could have, and we had some strong assumptions about the lease costs and delay system, because we didn't have information about how lease costs are shared by owner and crew. And we assumed that, based on the anecdotal information, some vessels or a lot of vessels, they take it out of the top of gross revenue, and then the vessel shares and crew shares are determined by the lay system. So we made those assumptions. And as a result, the results show that estimated profits for the active vessels rose from 5.6 million to 10 million in 2012 by 79%, and the crew shares were estimated to rise by 51%, total crew shares, in 2012. In terms of employment, we don't know the actual change in the number of crew members, because some crew members may be employed on different ships, shifts on different vessels. But if we estimate employment as crew times days at sea, overall total days at sea, it was estimated that employment declined by 3.7% in 2012, and this was mostly due to the increase in possession limit. Next slide shows the fleet diversity and concentration. As you can see from this chart, the LAGC IFQ fleet is quite diverse. However, the net revenues are highly concentrated among the top earning groups. For example, in 2012, about 9 owners at the top earned 25% of the net revenue, while at the bottom about 132 vessels, 2 owners earned about 25%, another 25% of the total net revenue. We also looked at the distribution, concentration of revenues and profits and allocations using the Lorentz curve and Gini coefficients. These are in your document. Figure 66 and table 15 provides more information. And basically, we have the same results. They all show all these different variables and metrics. Measures show that net revenues are not equally distributed, and that is mostly due to the unequal distribution of allocations at the beginning of the IFQ program in 2010. Finally, during the course of this research, we identified some further information needs. I already mentioned about fixed costs. There were only a handful of IFQ vessels included in the cost survey, and expanding that survey to include more of these vessels will provide a better estimates of fixed costs and profits. And similarly, we need more information about how lease costs are divided between the vessel owner and the crew. And also the information about the extent of borrowing by owners who lease quota from others was not available at this time. And it is important to have information about that because some owners mentioned that these borrowing costs are becoming a major cost item. We also need to have more information about the change in employment patterns in order to assess the impacts on employment, such as if the crew are employed part-time or year-round. It would be very helpful to have detailed information on that. And finally, there were some data challenges that we encountered during this report, working on this report. This report obviously required an extensive amount of data, over 300 permits for each of the 3 years for allocations, trip, leasing, transfers, ownership. And those data items were available in about a dozen separate databases. Now, parts of this information, several files were provided to us by staff at GARFO, and we accessed some of the information ourselves. However, putting together all that separate pieces of information in our office for each vessel owner for each year, it turned out to be a very challenging and time-consuming task because of some issues that some files not having common identifiers, and also allocations are determined at the beginning of the year and things change during the year, vessels are replaced or transferred to others. So that turned out to be very time-consuming, and there is more explanation about this in section 1 of your appendix. This was described as a, this issue was described as PDT finding number 2. Hopefully, going forward, if we could have another easier way to bring this data together, that could help with these kind of analysis. That we can do that in a more timely way. And at the committee meeting, committee voted on this. You can see in your slide. And that is all I have. I would be happy to answer any questions you may have, either now or later, but that's all I have for now.
Thank you very much. And Deirdre, questions for from the council. Tom.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Dee, Demet, thanks very much for the presentation. I had, I guess, two questions. First, to Demet, what are you using for the ex-vessel price estimates? Are you utilizing real-time information for auction, like recent auctions?
Dealer data revenues and landings. And for this report, we used, of course, the dealer data revenues and landings for the IFQ fishery. And the prices for the IFQ fishery were a little higher than the overall ex-vessel prices for the scallop fishery as a whole.
So are we using at least 2013 information now that that fishing year is
No, this report includes up till the end of 2012 fishing year. But the next five-year review is supposed to include all of that information.
Great. The second question is to Deirdre. Looking at the AP report in the scallop tab, there was a motion specific to the IFQ report and some discussion, I think, about a motion that passed 802 and some discussion about the IFQ report not addressing the two potential threats to the gen cat fishery, and those were the impacts, I think, of inshore groundfish AMs or groundfish bycatch, as well as issues with regards to depleted inshore areas. Could you talk a little bit about that? I think that conversation ended up was a discussion about those issues, no firm solutions identified, but a commitment to continue discussing that at the AP level. Am I right on that?
Yes, you are, Tom. That did not get picked up, if you will, at the committee level. It was a much longer discussion at the committee, at the AP level, after 6 o'clock kind of thing, and people did talk a lot about it, recognize that both of those are important issues, big issues that, you know, couldn't be probably tackled, the next day. The committee didn't pick up on it. Again, honestly, a bit of timing probably. They got through the IFQ report. They acted on the kind of more direct things that were in the PDT findings and so forth, but they did not address that AP consensus statement directly.
Just to follow up on that, maybe for the for other members of the council, there's been a lot of discussion in the general category fleet and in the Northern Gulf of Maine fleet about the impacts or potential impacts of focused concentrated harvest by larger vessels on inshore areas, as well as the impacts of AMs, either current groundfish accountability measures, spatial measures inshore, or potential measures that would be triggered in the future, and their impacts on the inshore fleet, Northern Gulf of Maine and general category. I do think that those two things are things that fishermen in both those fleets see as real threats. And we talked a little bit about Northern Gulf of Maine this morning, but hopefully that this will be on the and Dee can let us know, but this will be on the agenda for AP meetings in the future. I think we need to understand those things better and ultimately start crafting discussions and solutions. And I think the AP took a pretty important step to elevating that issue and committing to moving forward on it. But I just wanted to sort of discuss that at the council level and hopefully, based on the motion from the AP report, that will be on future AP agendas.
Mary Beth.
So the report itself, I think, is something for the council to consider. And it does bring up issues of, you know, are there any necessary changes to the program that need to take place? And from my perspective, I think that is a discussion certainly that would be appropriate to have under priorities. And we will be going back to the AP and the committee prior to our priority discussion in the fall. And if people have issues to raise, from my perspective, that would be the appropriate way to do it.
Tom, follow-up?
Yeah, so with that said, I think that's a reasonable idea. Could we add this to the list of issues that come up under priorities that are discussed by the scallop committee when we have that discussion? We always get sort of a laundry list of issues that have come up over the year when we're setting priorities to discuss.
If I can jump in, Terry, to be clear, usually the list that I bring back is something that the council has at some level officially had a comment about. I don't usually go back and dig through, you know, PDT or AP level things because they're pretty broad and all over. So I wouldn't and I don't go back to that level. It usually the list that I bring to those first initial meetings are things that either was a council motion or, you know, has specifically been identified by the executive committee on the list of priorities. And I don't know if you need a motion to add these to it, but you know, I don't go back and dig them out of the summaries that way.
Tom, then we're going to...
I don't think we need a motion. I don't think anybody would object to considering this as part of that discussion. So maybe by consensus, this could just be considered at that time as something that we think about and think about in the context of all the other things that we're going to be addressing.
David Pierce.
Demet, actually for both, much of the information that's provided in the performance report is presented in the form of averages, especially when we get to revenue. And average information is interesting, but it doesn't tell the whole story regarding what's going on in the fishery. It just doesn't tell the story. Averages have limited use in terms of understanding performance and understanding what's happening, you know, with this important fishery. So my suggestion is that for the next go around, 5 years down the road or whenever it may be, if there could be more information provided, you know, buried down a little bit deeper, provide information that goes well beyond averages, that I think is more informative. So that's a suggestion as to how the report could be improved when it's done again.
Well, actually, Section 3.3.12 of the report looks at the distribution of net revenue from several perspectives. There is graphs about I have to go to that section. We looked at the distribution of revenue using the Lorentz curves, Gini coefficients, as well as different revenue groups. I agree that section could be expanded. We could include more, but if you look at figure 63, for example, on page 81 of that section, it shows the number of active IFQ owners by net revenue group. And like in 2010, there were 67 owners which made $10,000 in net revenue, and there were only 18 owners in that year that derived a revenue of $300,000 or more. And figure 64 shows these averages by each group, still averages, but averages by each group. And then we have the information about the quadrants. And we also looked at the Lorentz curves, but it is possible to include more detailed disaggregation of the fleet in terms of the distribution of revenues in that section.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that explanation and reference to that particular figure. It's useful, but again, overall, many of the tables talk about averages. So, again, just a suggestion for down the road, because I was a bit hindered in terms of trying to work through this report and really understand what has happened in this fishery. So,
also, I also want to mention, because I couldn't go through, there's so much information in the document, I also want to mention that we looked at the net revenue by leasing groups separately, by active and versus inactive groups. But we can look at it in terms of the maybe vessel size. Maybe that's another distribution, although the majority of the vessels in this fishery are smaller vessels. We can definitely look at it from other perspectives. And if you have any other perspective you would like to suggest for us to look, please let me know.
John, then Mike.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Dement and Deirdre, for the report. I had some questions, actually, not of Deirdre and Dement, but of Logan and Deirdre, because a couple of the findings touched on enforcement and on the finding number two and the committee motion about working with GARFO on coordinating information. And I would just be interested to get Logan's take on the enforcement issues, if he's willing to step to the mic, which he appears to be willing to do.
Logan, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So do we have the slide that had enforcement? That might help me
a little bit.
A lot of this goes back to, I know one of the things was the information of not calling in. So one of the issues we have, and this isn't just for this particular fishery, but analysis of data in general, is I don't have analysts in my office, and I don't have staff to go through and analyze what is happening versus what is supposed to happen versus what isn't happening. So to the extent that we can work with the region to come up with some better ways to do that, we definitely want to do that so that we can be on top of this in an earlier fashion. The other part of it is we rely heavily, especially in the time frame from 2010 to 2012, on our state JEA partners for a lot of these checks at the dock. I have right now 6 enforcement officers from Maine to Virginia and 18 special agents who are tasked with not just, you know, obviously enforcement of general category scallops, but every fishery management plan, and including protected resources issues and IUU fishing and wildlife trafficking and other issues. So what I'd like to kind of get a sense from the council is, and even from the industry or in the region, is, you know, what would be a good percentage of landings for us to check? So I know that we've, you know, touched on, you know, a number here that is more of a guesstimate, because our records management system doesn't track our efforts by, you know, fishery management plan per se. It's just, you know, how many boardings, how many inspections have we conducted overall. So if, let's say, there are 1,000 landings, you know, what would be the percentage that we would need to touch to be an adequate accounting for compliance? And that would help me determine, you know, the effort level that I would need to have in these particular areas. So from a staffing perspective and from a, you know, a resource perspective on my end, you know, how many people do I need? Or how many state officers do I need to have assigned to this particular area of compliance checks? So those are some of the things that I struggle with. And again, it's not just this. It's everything that we have to do. But we, you know, we want to do as much as we can, but we are limited.
John?
I assume right now we're not going to get Logan his answer, but we're going to ponder that. But I would like, because thank you, Logan, for that. Emily, if you have comments on the coordination from our end, would you make them?
Sure, and this had a lot to deal, maybe even less with the enforcement aspect of it, but some of the PDT finding that we needed to coordinate more with council staff in doing this cost or this report overall. I think that what this is in a lot of ways been lessons learned on how to move forward and work with our different divisions to be able to come together and figure out the sort of interfaces that you need to met and that we need to provide for you in order to figure out a lot of the data issues that we had. So I think that moving forward, we've already discussed this, but there's a better plan for moving ahead. So just so everyone knows that.
Mike.
Yeah, quick comment on the enforcement aspect of this. It seems pretty clear to me that there could be a quite an effective automated system to cross-check all the various documents that are involved in this, so that you know if you know whether people are actually calling in, you know how that relates to their VMS and all those sort of things, and that needs to be addressed in terms of the enforcement aspects. The issue of data that was raised, or the problems that were faced in data, specifically mentioned the problem or concerned about unique identifiers in terms of the trips, and that has been a widespread concern in terms of the database for more than 20 years. So I hope the message is heard again and addressed. I had I apologize for not complimenting the people who put this together, to both you and your colleagues. It's a very good report, and I think it's a very positive thing that's been undertaken to do this sort of evaluation of how our systems are working. And frankly, I'm impressed with the results I've seen, not only with all the work that's been done, but overall the system seems to be working reasonably well. I mean, it's not perfect, but there's some pretty positive indicators. One that I found interesting was the value of permanent transfer of quota, which seemed to be about roughly twice the ex-vessel value of a unit of quota. I think there were numbers like $17 per pound, which is, you know, sort of the order of twice what ex-vessel value is. And there's a 13 to 23? Okay, sort of the order of twice. That I find to be an important number. And I like Demet's experience in this, but an experience I've had in various analyses of ITQ fisheries, when there's sort of a mature market for quota, it tends to be a value of 2 to 3, a little more than 2 times the ex-vessel value. So this, given that it's a relatively new fishery, this is sort of approaching that level, which to me makes sense. Things, markets are working reasonably well. There's another implication of it. If that number had been 5 times, the only way that could be rational is if somebody's cheating and landing a lot of illegal scallops. And there are fisheries where that is used as an indicator of abuse, because people are buying quota for more than it's worth, unless they're basically using it as a license to the ground so they can land more than they're entitled to. So I also think it's a very good sign that the number here is sort of consistent with what you would expect. It isn't out of line. So thank you. Well, I guess my question to Demet, since we are asking questions, was does she have any knowledge or experience of what you would expect the value of quota to be in a rationalized fishery? Thank you.
Answer for that at this time.
Ellen.
Thank you very much. That was a very detailed report, and it was really excellent. I had a question for Deidre about the enforcement and the vessels that have not been calling in for pre-landing. And I was just wondering, I know that there's been a problem with the day boat fleet. The six-hour landing time is longer than they are out at times. So I'm wondering if any of that, those 30 vessels are, since they're landing, I think they're landing small amounts, could they be vessels that are fishing close to the demarcation line and don't have the time to call in before they land? I just wondered.
It is a good point, and the data that the agency provided us did include the total trip length of each of those individual trips. I didn't dig into it super close to be able to answer for sure. My impression, though, just quickly from it, was that maybe the answer is no, and that it does just seem that when you have it wasn't just one location. That was my sense, that it was a little different than that, but I can check that more closely to really look at how long those trips were. They did provide that as well. We didn't include that in these summary tables, but I could look into it further.
Thank you. And I think that even if the trips are longer than that, they may not. I'm just trying to rationalize, I guess, but I'm thinking that there are times when they don't know when they're going to be landing 6 hours in advance. I mean, if you have like a 5-day trip, obviously you know, but if you have a day trip or a 2-day trip, that might be problematic.
I could just add on, I think, to be honest with you, because it's a small group, my impression from talking to the staff at the agency is that they're going to be really reaching out directly to a lot of these people. So I think whatever the reasons are, hopefully we will learn what they are, and they'll be corrected by the time we do this again.
Other questions from the council? Are there any questions from the audience? Dick.
My name's Dick Allen, and I'm speaking as a private citizen who is interested in achieving the greatest overall benefits to the nation from fisheries, as the Magnuson Act instructs us to do. And for that reason, I'm really excited about this report. Finally, we're looking at information that can really give us some insights into the net benefits that the nation is receiving from a fishery. So much of what we do, you know, doesn't really get at that basic purpose of the Magnuson Act. So this is one I really commend the staff for putting this together, and I'm looking forward to more of this kind of thing, not only on this fishery, but on other fisheries, so we can really see how our fishery management systems performing in terms of producing net benefit to the nation. One specific that I had a little problem with, and I spoke to the DeMet about this a little bit, and it doesn't take away from the overall value of the report at all, but the table that shows average net revenue by lease groups, it implies that, at least the way I read it, that there's this last three words, zero lease cost, because a group that doesn't lease in fish, it says they have zero lease cost. And I think a lot of people might take that to mean that they don't have a cost associated with the quota that they're using. And I think that's the wrong implication, that everybody, whether you own quota or lease quota, there's a cost associated with that quota. And what economists would normally do in an economic analysis is to value all the inputs at their opportunity costs. And so this is where you'd start to see, and it might change the relative positions, how it looks like the different groups are doing. And I think that'll be important as we go forward. And it's also important in trying to figure out what the incentives people are facing in terms of whether they're going to sell out of a fishery or buy into it or lease out their quota rather than fishing it. So I think it's kind of a key that as we move forward with these kind of things, we need to try to get some information on that and incorporate it into these kind of reports. But like I say, I'm really excited. I know the rest of you are excited about this report as I am, and looking forward to more of it. Thanks.
Are there any other questions from the audience? Seeing none, Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have one motion from the committee on this, and then I'm after we deal with that motion, I have another motion I'd like to make based on the conversation that occurred at the committee. So the motion I make on behalf of the committee is to recommend that Garfo address as a priority the issues identified in the IFQ report related to data challenges. And if you look at the last slide of Deirdre's presentation, you can see the PD finding number 2, and this motion is based on the concerns or the difficulties they encountered when trying to access the data they needed for the report.
Committee motion that doesn't need a second. Are there any comments from the audience? Seeing none, back to the council. You have a question, Tom?
Yeah, I think some of those issues related to tracking ownership data, correct, Demet?
Not just the ownership data.
Right. I guess my point is, so with respect to ownership data, I just want to point out we've had similar problems with the groundfish plan, so I hope when this goes forward that we don't just address the ownership issues for scallops, but we look at a broader mm-hmm. issue.
Yeah, we had also issues identifying which vessels lease their quota to which owners, for example. And, you know, matching the allocations with the landings later on, because allocations were shown in terms of moratorium IDs, landings in a different way. Very, very, I could go on that, but there's detailed information in the appendix.
Are there any further comments from the council? Seeing none, those who support the motion on the board, please indicate so. Motion carries 14 to 0. Mary Beth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So there is one additional consensus statement, regarding the report from the committee, and it was the concern about the level of monitoring and enforcement. It was quite late in the day, and we couldn't really seem to wrap our brains around, you know, exactly how to deal with that. So I have a motion that I've provided to Joan, and I will read it, that I would request the council send a letter to Garfo expressing our concerns about VMS compliance, the low level of offload monitoring, and IFQ overages in the general category IFQ scallop fishery. And if I get a second, I'll provide some rationale.
Seconded by PK.
So I think that, you know, listening to Logan's comments, that perhaps a letter like this might actually be helpful to him to use in discussions with his state partners, that the council has made this a priority. The committee was concerned about the low level of offload monitoring and this VMS issue. And then the IFQ overages, I think it's really not clear if there's a problem or not. I think we are not familiar enough with what the current catch monitoring system is and how that works. It just, the report raises issues, and perhaps the agency could help clarify that for us.
Are there any comments on the motion on the board from the audience? Seeing none, back to the council. John.
So Logan's question was, what in thinking about the letter, was what is the appropriate level? So the motion is, tell us that it's low. Logan's question was, what's the appropriate? So in the letter, if you can address that, I think it would be, I agree, it would be helpful to Logan.
Any further comment? Seeing none, those support the motion on the board, please indicate so. The motion carries 14 to 0. Mary Beth.
So just one last comment on this section. I think if I say this correctly, Deirdre, if not, please correct me, but one of the findings was discussed whether or not we agreed with it or not. And I think that, we had a good discussion about it. This is a draft report. It will go back to the PDT, and they will consider, the discussions and comments we had and make modifications if they think it's appropriate, because it is a PDT report. And so I just wanted to let people know because, in further discussion, that seemed the best thing to do when it was raised at the committee meeting. And do we have anything else, Deirdre? I think that's it for us for now.
Super. Well, as usual, great work from the Scallop Committee, AP, and PDT. We are going to take a short break and come back to consider the request for emergency action. So try to make it 5 minutes.